This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. How will lifting the mask mandate affect Hoosiers? We'll find out in a moment from our guests. If you'd like to join the conversation or have any questions, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. With us today, we have Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, and Tom Szyszynski, Epidemiology Education Director at the IUPUI Richard Fairbanks School of Public Health. Welcome to both of you. We'll start with you, Brandon. As you know, the statewide mask mandate is expected to be lifted tomorrow. What's going to change with the lifting of this mandate? Is it going to be the same as we've been seeing now? Some people masking, some not?
I think so. I mean, we have a small handful of counties around the state who are going to keep their mask mandates in place, but that's a very small number. The vast majority of counties will no longer be under any sort of mask mandate because the state is ending its mask mandate. Now, we've been talking about this for a long time. The governor never really enforced his mask mandate. He emphasized that it was about education and not enforcement, so that they weren't, you know, the mask police weren't roaming Indiana. So, it raises a question of how much will really change. Maybe not a lot in a lot of places. But I think what I've been hearing from some folks is, particularly businesses, they felt like right now, with or without a pandemic, a private business can require you to wear a mask, just as they can require you to wear a shirt, shoes, in order to get service. But because the masks have been so controversial and politicized, a lot of businesses felt like the governor's order, even if it wasn't being enforced by the state, backed them up. You know, they could point to, hey, the state of Indiana says you need to wear a mask when you're in public. Without that now, unless you're in one of those very small number of counties, without that, business owners feel like they're kind of out on their own in trying to enforce this thing. Some will, some won't. Some might get into some trouble with angry customers, but it certainly gives them a little less backup.
And that's a tricky situation to be in if you don't have something to sort of back you up, as you're mentioning. So what is the difference between a mandate and an advisory when it comes to masks?
Distinction without a difference in terms of certainly, like I just talked about, the governor never really enforced his mask mandate. So you could argue it's been an advisory all along. Technically, it could have been enforced, but it really wasn't. Again, I think it goes to that idea of businesses feel like they don't have the state's back. The governor says you should. He's not saying you have to. So we say you should, but we'd really like you to. But, you know, so I don't really think there's any difference there.
When it comes to the data, Tom, I'd like to ask you, what are we seeing specifically that would make the governor choose to lift this? Is there anything that's relevant in that area, or is it just he just felt like it?
Well, I have to give the governor some credit because throughout the pandemic, he has been listening to public health and has been looking at the data showing, you know, what's happening in terms of deaths and illnesses and such. When looking at what we just came out of, like the October, November, December, January case numbers, our case numbers are really dropped off dramatically, right? And now we have three vaccines in the state. And we have about 17.5% of the state that's been vaccinated fully, right? So those are some good things to have. Those are definitely some good signs. The mask mandate, I think, is just another piece of the puzzle or piece of the pie, really, in terms of slowing this down, right? Having the vaccines, seeing those numbers drop, having masks, good hand hygiene, you know, staying physically distanced, all those things combined will get us to the end of the pandemic sooner.
And having all of these vaccines available, not necessarily everybody's going to take them. And we're hearing more about this B.1.1.7 variant that's coming to play. It just seems from the outside perspective that this is a perfect storm. It's like there's a new variant coming on. Everybody take your masks off. How can we be sure that we're safe?
Yeah, I think we're in a foot race here of can we get enough people vaccinated and get them, you know, developing antibodies? Because even the day you get your last vaccine, you still have about 2 weeks before you're fully protected. And we get these variants now coming into the state, right? So I think we're definitely in this race to get more people vaccinated and prevent the spread of disease. And it's encouraging because we're seeing people sign up for the vaccines, but it's just going to take time.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, Brandon, we know that there are some counties that are preferring to keep a mask mandate in place. Can you tell us where those are in the state?
I don't have the exhaustive list actually in front of me. I know Marion County was the first to sign up. Marion County, who has kind of been out in the lead in terms of some of the going further than the state's restrictions, said right away, I believe Joe Hogsett, the mayor of Indianapolis, said he's going to keep the mask mandate in place basically as long as it's legally possible to do so, which is as long as the public health emergency declared by the state is in place, which is at least through the end of April and could be renewed again. But again, it's a very small number. I want to say St. Joseph County, I believe Lake County, Monroe County, I believe, is on that list. But beyond that, I don't think there are many. And again, that's not a surprise because those are the sort of the counties that have tried to go a little further than the state this whole time throughout the pandemic.
And aside from these counties, I think we're also hearing that neighboring states are feeling a little bit frustrated, especially if they're choosing to keep their mask mandates in place. I want to take a moment to play a clip we have from a media briefing last week. This is Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear. Let's take a listen.
Kentuckians are going to be more at risk if Tennesseans are not under a mask mandate, which they haven't been for a while. But Indiana ending theirs is also concerning. Now, what I will say is Governor Holcomb has been flexible at different times in the past, where he has moved a certain direction and then either cases increase or others, and they've at least stopped. So my hope is he hears the president's call and reconsiders.
And to clarify the president's call, President Joe Biden has been urging states not to lift their mask mandates. Tom, do you think the concerns of Governor Beshear are fair, that Kentuckians are at more risk if Tennessee or Indiana decide, well, they've already decided to take their mask mandates down?
Well, I definitely think it's going to put more pressure on the state if, you know, other states and everyone else is saying, look, let's just lift our mask mandates. Why are we still having a mask mandate? But I have to agree with Brandon in that this idea of, you know, not enforcing this didn't help the situation. And I think it's going to even add a little bit more confusion where you have some counties now that have a mask mandate still and others don't. So if I live in one county and work in another, you know, and I'm bouncing between those counties, I think we're contributing to part of the problem.
Mm-hmm. Lots of confusion for sure. And Brandon, you know, when the cases go up, because I'm pretty sure that they are going to go up, we're seeing some of the data, it fluctuates. Do you think the governor will put the mandate back in place? Does that seem like that's on the table for him?
The governor has been asked that question twice since he announced that he was getting rid of all the restrictions, the day after and then last week at his last regular weekly briefing that he'll have on COVID-19. And both times he said, you know, as he has said throughout the pandemic, I follow the data. If the data starts to look bad, then yes, everything is on the table. That's what he said. Now, what I believe is that, no, I don't think we are ever going to see any statewide COVID-19 restrictions reimposed in Indiana. I think that there, despite what the governor has said, despite his claims to the contrary, he is under significant political pressure from the General Assembly. There are lawmakers, and not a small number of them, who are ready to end the public emergency right now. And if the governor had not gotten rid of all of the restrictions, I think they were prepared to do that. And that creates a whole host of problems because the public health emergency triggers a lot more than just the governor being able to impose a mask mandate. It has to do with a lot of federal programs and money that come to the state of Indiana. If we get rid of that public health emergency, that money and those programs go away. So that would be a kind of disastrous thing for Indiana to do. But I think lawmakers don't care. Lawmakers hate the mask mandate, particularly Republican lawmakers. And they were ready to cut the governor's knees off, period, if he didn't get rid of these restrictions, which is why I don't think, barring things really taking a turn for the worse, and I mean really, really taking a turn for the worse, and specifically what I mean there is what we saw a few months ago, around like late December and early January, where you had hospitals across the state who were turning patients away because they simply did not have the capacity to treat them. If we got into that sort of situation again, I absolutely think the governor would respond with restrictions. With the rate of vaccination that we're seeing, maybe I'm being optimistic, but I don't think we're going to get to that situation again. But if we do, that's the only scenario under which I can imagine the governor reimposing any restrictions.
And Tom, for you and other folks in public health, how frustrating is it to see that it's more of a political decision rather than one coming from a medical perspective, creating these rules and deciding what people should do?
Right. And, you know, that it's very frustrating because the science is clear that masks work, right? They work to protect you from other people and other people from you, right? It works both ways. I have to point out, though, that, you know, by moving to an advisory, it doesn't say you can't wear a mask, right? So I think there's this kind of personal decision and personal response kind of assessment or risk assessment individuals have to do and say, well, how much of a risk am I, right? Am I fully vaccinated? Do I, hang around people that are fully vaccinated? What's going on in terms of variants in the state? What does the vaccine, how does it work against those variants, right? So I think you have to kind of do your homework, assess your own risk. But I also think that we have a sense of social responsibility. Wearing a mask is the absolutely easiest thing anyone can do to help everyone out. I mean, it really is. So I think we really have to kind of weigh that as individuals and as a society.
Absolutely. Well, thank you both for coming on the program this afternoon. I will say this. I'm so used to wearing a mask that I can't imagine not wearing one. You know, it's fashion now, I think, for some of us. But thank you both for joining us. Brandon Smith is the State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Tom Szczynski is the Epidemiology Education Director at the IUPUI Richard Fairbanks School of Public Health. After the break, we'll hear an earlier conversation I had with two lawmakers who authored House Bill 1176 on elements of rape and find out how their proposed bill could change the way rape is defined. If you have questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Indiana already has laws around rape and sexual assault, but some lawmakers don't think they're strong enough. April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and we're talking with two state house representatives who are pushing to add another level to what can be considered rape. With us today, we have Indiana Republican House Representative Sharon Nagel and Indiana Democratic House Representative Sue Arrington. Thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nagel. What is House Bill 1176? I think that's kind of what we're going to delve into here. And what are the things that it's calling for?
So it addresses two deficits within our current rape statute. And there's been considerable study on these particular issues. We had a summer study that really addressed these two deficits. And so over that time period, we've come up with language to try to cover those two areas. First of all, we know that there is a deficit when it comes to the definition of consent. And the other piece that we know that was ignored within our statute has to do with fraud and deceit. So the language that we added covered both those issues.
You mentioned the word deficit. Is that a nice way of saying these aren't up to par?
That's another way to say it.
Well, Representative Arrington, in light of this legislation that's being pushed for, what is the current legislation around rape and sexual assault in Indiana to kind of help us get perspective on why more laws are needed or more additions?
Well, what's in the statute currently as rape is threat of force or force. So in other words, if you don't fight back, it doesn't fit that definition. Or it could be incapacitation, a rape drug, in, you know, out of it, or possibly having to do with the other option is if you're mentally incapable of understanding happening. So that's what the current definition of rape is in the statute.
Mm-hmm. And to most people, that might sound like that's a pretty hefty amount of things in there that would define rape. Representative Nagel, why is HB 1176 necessary if you already have some solid definitions in place?
Well, it's left to interpretation. One of my biggest concerns had to do with the testimony that we heard over the summer study, where a judge gives instruction to a jury. And one of the questions that a juror may ask is, well, what is meant by consent? And a judge, it can vary across the state on how they define consent. And most will just say, as what we heard in testimony in the summer study, is that you must use your common sense on what that means. Well, that's very concerning to me. And I felt that it was something that we needed to really clarify within the statute. So that was just glaring at us during our summer study. I mean, the other deficit, again, that was pointed out was the deceit side of it, where someone portrays themselves as the person's regular partner and in fact is not. And until the victim, as you know, doesn't realize it until too late. And that is a situation that did occur in our state. And that particular case went to court and was clarified that our current code didn't cover that situation.
Is that sort of a situation that prompted you to author this bill, or was there something else that motivated you to move forward with this?
I would say in combination. You know, I know Representative Arrington has been working very hard on this legislation also for a couple of years now. And after looking at the various deficits that we see, you know, we'd really try to hone in on exactly how we could address a lot of these issues within the statute itself, and just trying to make it so that it was very clear to our juries.
Mm-hmm. And Representative Arrington, Representative Nagel mentioned that you've been working on this type of legislation for some time. Is this a bipartisan issue in Indiana? Is there support on both sides?
Yes, there is. And I would say, especially among the women legislators, we can put ourselves in the shoes of someone who is a rape victim and understand it from that perspective. And, you know, I started looking at this legislation a couple of years ago because I could see that the public understanding of rape is changing. We've had some really high-profile rape cases, Harvey Weinstein, and those women were able to make the case about consent. And I think that opened a lot of people's eyes that often, I mean, rape is a very underreported crime, and part of it is because women don't think they'll get their day in court, a fair day in court. And I think when they saw that happen, you know, at the national level, it began to give women hope that, you know, maybe things can change here in Indiana too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so would you say it's fair to say that the Me Too movement kind of spurred some action on these bills in Indiana?
Absolutely. It did for me, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it did for others.
And to clarify for our audience, you know, this bill or these things that you're pushing for the definition of rape wouldn't apply just to women, but, you know, also men who are victims of these types of horrible crimes.
Yes.
So
exactly.
Well, let's take a little bit of a look at these previous bills that Representative Arrington, you've supported as well. There's a lot of majority of Republicans supporting some of these bills compared to Democrats. So is there a reason behind that? Is there a reason why there aren't a lot of Democrats behind some of these bills?
Well, I think it's mainly the numbers of Republicans in the legislature and numbers of Democrats. I think if you go by percentages, you'll find that overwhelming number of Democrats are supportive of this type of legislation. The other thing that in the House is when you file a bill, our rules say that you can only have four names on it unless the speaker opens it up for more. And so in this case, you know, we have more Republicans in the House. And so there are, you want to make sure you get as many of the majority as you can in support of a bill. So that's one reason that you would look at having the kind of distribution on your bill that you have.
Well, if you're just joining us, we're talking with two lawmakers about their efforts to make changes to current laws around rape in Indiana. Representative Nagel, why do you think it's been difficult to pass this legislation in Indiana if this is an issue that has bipartisan support? You know, the public is supportive of this type of legislation. What is the issue?
Well, when it comes to the criminal issue, we deal with two our organizations. That would be the prosecutor's side of it and the public defender side of it. So we're always dealing kind of with opposing views. And it's understandable because each of them are representing opposite sides. And so when you're crafting code, you're always trying to keep both sides into consideration. But you will always deal with trying to pass legislation where one side will be against it when you're addressing criminal code. It is pretty rare when both prosecutors and the public defenders agree. And since I sit on courts in criminal code, I get to view this constantly within various criminal code legislation. And this issue is argued that, you know, the existing code works well, that judges' instructions should do well enough, or it should be the, you know, case precedents should be able to cover these issues. And the prosecuting side will tell you that, no, you know, we need to spell it out better. And I tend to agree with more on the prosecutor's side that I think we need to spell it out better. And we need to make sure that there is the juror, it's very clear to the jury what consent means. So those are the opposing sides we will always deal with when it comes to changing criminal code.
And what is the consent currently? What is the law on the books for consent, and what would the changes be?
So that's the problem.
Well, currently, that's the problem. Exactly. It's not defined. It's really based on either previous case law that a judge wants to give to a jury via instruction, or it's a judge saying, use your common sense.
And if someone doesn't have common sense, how is that defined?
and therein lies the problem.
Yeah, and what we find then is with different instructions in different counties, you're going to have maybe different results.
So then when this, if this passes and if this goes into law, would it make all of the counties around Indiana, would everybody have to follow this?
Yes, that they would look at that as the state statute, and that's so yes.
So it would put everybody on the same page, basically.
Yes. Exactly.
Now I'm a little curious, how is it that these bills seem to have more trouble? Or at least it seems that way in the House than the Senate, or is it the opposite?
I would say the opposite.
Is there a reason for that? Why it would be harder to pass in one area than the other?
So I think the reason is that, you know, the House tends to be the first clearinghouse on sometimes the most controversial issues that then head over to the Senate. But it also tends to be probably a younger makeup of people who serve in the House. It is also 100 legislators versus 50. And so I think we have maybe just more diversity and more of a younger age group that looks at these issues.
And Representative Arrington, we touched earlier that you've been in support and you've even authored similar bills around this before. Did any of those proposed bills pass?
No, they didn't. And that's one reason we made a switch this year, just the political realities of being in the minority. It's much harder, I'm in the minority. Representative Nagel is in the majority party. It's much harder for someone in the minority to get a bill through, to even get one heard, actually. And so we both felt that this is such an important issue. It didn't really matter to us who was the first name on the bill. It's getting it passed that's the most important thing. And if having a Republican as the lead author will make that happen, then I'm okay with that.
And has there been any progress at all in these bills? I know, you know, we're talking about HB 1176, but has there been any other progress before this bill that you're working on?
On this issue?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the fact that we got it to a study committee was incremental progress. And that probably helped lead us to where we're at now, because the chair of the Courts and Criminal Code Committee did give it a hearing. That was its first step, really. And by the way, that chair is a woman. That could have helped too.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like there's still a lot of maybe some old patterns and behavior in state government that is preventing some of these things from going through. Is that accurate?
Well, we are a very slow machine is what I would describe it as. You know, it's while we sometimes feel like things move way too slow, in some cases we have to say, you know, maybe that was a good idea that took time. Because we were able to really vet that issue and make sure that we were doing the right thing within our state statute. So I can tell you as a legislator that sometimes I feel frustrated by the slowness and the progress on changing laws or adding to laws. But in essence, it is a pretty good vetting process where we have to go through summer study and really hear testimony and discuss all the potential problems or successes that can be with these changes. And this particular issue, Representative Arrington and I both worked together on trying to get this as a summer study. It was a very successful summer study because we were able to really create some momentum on crafting this language and getting a hearing. And so while it's frustrating at moments, it really is an example of a success of moving forward. Now, we still have some work left to do, as you well know, in getting having this hearing. We're having a hearing next week in the Senate, and we will see where we end up landing. But this is a major step forward for us, and we're a team, Sue and I, on this.
Now, are you confident that the Senate hearing will go well next week?
You know, you never know.
I'd like to. We'd like to be confident. How's that sound?
For people who are listening and want to know, you know, if this is actually going to go anywhere, what is the next step after the hearing?
Well, then it'll go to the whole Senate. But, you know,
so it goes through the committee process first.
And if you're asking what can your listeners do if they want to see this passed, contacting the chair of the Senate committee and the members of it. They're the ones that will be voting next.
All right. Well, I think that pretty much covers this topic, and I really appreciate you both taking the time to join us. We'll definitely keep an eye on this bill and see where it goes. Thank you so much. We were joined today by Indiana Republican House Representative Sharon Nagel and Indiana Democratic House Representative Sue Arrington. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. The interview you heard just before the break was taped earlier, so to clarify to our listeners, the hearing on House Bill 1176 is scheduled for later this week. April is full of different programs and events to promote action and education on ending sexual assault. An event that many organizations and clubs on college campuses hold is called Take Back the Night. This is a night where many survivors share their own stories, and we have a clip from Take Back the Night Foundation's global virtual event in October last year. Let's take a listen.
It's only now, 3 years on, that I am removed enough from the experience, the people, and the surrounding traumatic events that I can begin to deal with the pain. I am so sad for me and for what I went through. I am also continually shocked by how strong I am and can be. I don't understand how I could survive not only the experience, but all the hate I then brought on myself as a consequence. The greatest form of self-love I have experienced has been the ability to let myself heal.
That was part of a survivor story shared during Take Back the Night's virtual event last year. Powerful testimony. We're continuing our conversation about sexual assault, and now we'll hear from different groups around the state what they're doing to raise awareness and show support to survivors. You can join the conversation by reaching out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. With us now are Caitlin Vincey, a student and an It's On Us campus coordinator for Students for Gender Violence Awareness Club at the University of Southern Indiana. And Tracy Krueger is the president and CEO of the Indiana Coalition to End Sexual Assault and Human Trafficking. Tracy, let's start. Can you tell us a little bit about your organization and the work you're doing in Indiana?
Yes, thank you very much for having me. The coalition is the CDC-designated sexual assault coalition for the state. And our job basically is to look at how services are delivered throughout Indiana, where are there barriers, where are there gaps, and what can we be doing to build those collaborations and partnerships to ensure that survivors have access to all the services that they need and deserve. We also have a very strong prevention program because sexual assault and human trafficking are 100% preventable. So we are equally as committed to that in terms of raising awareness, ending rape culture, and calling on all Hoosiers to address their behaviors and be effective bystanders in ending sexual violence.
And Caitlin, you are with some organizations on your campus. How did Students for Gender Violence Awareness, I guess it's a club, start?
We originated, a few of us kind of recognized the magnitude of this issue that was happening on our campus. And we had an understanding that while this is our university, this is a nationwide epidemic that we're dealing with in terms of sexual assault. And truly, we understood that students are the ones that hold the power. And so we came together and collaborated and started up an organization to try and eradicate the violence that happens on our campus.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about, Tracy, you mentioned something. You said the words rape culture. Can we define that for our listeners? What exactly is that?
Oh, yes. And it'd be great for Caitlin to weigh in on this, too. Rape culture is that attitude that permeates across the spectrum when it comes to victimizing those who have been sexually assaulted. Oftentimes when, and this is why many people don't report if they've been sexually assaulted, because they become blamed for the behavior. We don't hold the perpetrators accountable. We blame the victims. What were you wearing? Had you been drinking? Why were you there? What did you think would happen? And immediately we have reshifted the focus on the person who's the victim of the crime. This is the only crime in which that happens. And so by allowing that to continue, we are really silencing the voices of survivors, and we are also allowing the perpetration to continue. Rape culture is also found in movies and in advertisements and in locker room banter and water cooler jokes and jokes about anatomy, all the things. So if we don't start working toward ending that, then we are also perpetuating that culture.
And Caitlin, I see that you're nodding your head to what Tracy's saying. What are your thoughts on all of this?
I agree 100% with Tracy. This is one of the only crimes where the victim seems to be questioned first. Whenever there's a bank robbery, we don't ask, well, why was all that money in the bank in the first place? You know, that's kind of, it's more of a narrative that seems to happen. And with the Me Too movement and all of these huge social justice movements happening right now, it seems that on social media, we're seeing it where people are questioning, well, why, what was the victim wearing and why were they out drinking that late? And instead of turning and asking, well, why didn't that person stop whenever the victim said no? Or why did they ignore all of the signs that the person was incapacitated and unable to consent? And so changing that culture is kind of the first step in changing any violence that happens in our communities.
Mm-hmm. And I have to say, you know, from sort of a perspective of watching this stuff for years, these kinds of topics and covering things as a reporter, I'm a bit shocked that this is still needing to be a conversation, to be honest. And then you mentioned, Caitlin, social media is perpetuating this. I would be thinking, well, the younger folks are the ones that are, you know, woke on social media, and they're telling people, you know, what to do, what not to do, and they're all up to par with what's going on. But it sounds like it's actually a tool that's silencing some of these victims.
Yes, absolutely. I've seen where social media has been a very powerful thing for survivors and for this movement, but I've also seen on the flip side that there's still a gap in people's understanding of where the blame rests with sexual violence, and that it's never the victim's fault. And yet, for some reason, we're constantly putting the victim in the spotlight. And there seems to be a misconception that victims gain something whenever they report. Like, people like to assume that if a person accuses a power, that they somehow they're going after them for the money or for the fame. But in reality, survivors lose so much whenever they come forward. They are subjected to a lot of hate.
And Tracy, you mentioned some prevention is part of this. What are some of the programs the coalition is doing to, I guess, educate folks?
I'm happy to share that. I do want to just really quickly insert a couple of statistics, because I also think, along with what Caitlin was saying, is that we really struggle with the fact that this even exists, right? We're slow to accept the statistics. And actually, 1 in 5 Hoosier women will be sexually assaulted in their lifetime. We're 4th highest in the nation for the number of high school girls who are reported being raped. So this is with us. And this is also a very difficult topic to discuss. The other thing is, it's one of the most underreported crimes. And for all the reasons that we've been discussing, victims are absolutely put on trial through public opinion when they come forward and report being sexually assaulted, often because they know the perpetrator or people know the perpetrator. Very few cases are stranger danger where somebody jumps out of the bushes. There is a relationship there. It may not be an intense, in-depth relationship, but there is acknowledgement of the perpetrator and who it is. So we just don't want to talk about it. So that's the first thing. And that's one of the things that we really address in our primary prevention conversations. This is not about ending sexual violence. Isn't about risk reduction. This isn't about telling women to carry mace in their purse and walk on lighted streets. This is about getting to the root causes of what causes sexual assault. And it's all about oppression. It's about having control over another human being. And so that's really what we have to talk about. And so why does that happen? You know, it comes down to all of the in a simple word, it's oppression. And it has nothing to do about sex. It has everything to do about having control over another person. And so any normal social cues are just ignored. So we have to, first of all, address that. But secondly, we also have to work with all of us as community members on, you know, we are so, what we do is we mind our own business, and we don't want to get involved in other people's situations. And what we have to do is stop doing that. There are effective ways to be bystanders. And It's On Us does a fabulous job of focusing on that. On how do we become effective bystanders to end sexual violence? And then also, what is our role in ending rape culture? You know, jokes about bodies are not funny. Jokes about weekend conquests or bragging about weekend conquests, that's not funny. And we've got to start saying that's unacceptable, and or just walk away from those conversations. Don't condone that by laughing or staying in the conversations. I mean, there's just some really easy things that we can do to be very clear about, you know, this isn't a joke. It isn't funny. Mm-hmm. And we all have some culpability in making sure that the behavior stops.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Caitlin, you have this club on your campus. Do you feel that it's important to have something like this on campus? And what have your, I guess, experiences been so far with the things that you're trying to do?
Absolutely. It's vital that we have something like this on campus. Our organization has the unique opportunity to serve as kind of the bridge between students and administration. Survivors are statistically less likely to want to have administration be the first people that they report to. So we've been working in three areas, and that's advocacy, prevention, programming, and support. And so one of the main focuses that we've been doing this year is we've conducted listening sessions so we can gain a better understanding from survivors about what they think needs to be changed on our campus, because their voices are the ones that matter. And then we conducted a survey to allow survivors who didn't feel comfortable about coming to our in-person listening sessions to kind of give their perspective. And shockingly enough, only 8% of students felt that our university was doing enough to stop sexual assault. And one thing I think that's shocking to the general public is that the entire mission of our work is to increase the number of reports that happen at our university. Because if we know statistically, if 1 in 4 college students are experiencing sexual violence at their time during their university, but there's only 10 reports a year, that tells us that students don't feel safe enough to report, not that less than 10 assaults are happening every year. And so this year, we have crafted a proposal to our university from our the grievances from students and from our research, and we presented that to them last week. And right now, we're kind of just awaiting their response. But in the meantime, it's Sexual Assault Awareness Month, so we're in full swing with our prevention programming. We're having speakers. We're having panel discussions. We have bystander intervention trainings. So we're incredibly busy, but also incredibly focused on eradicating this issue.
And how has the university responded to your efforts? Do you feel like they're in support, or is there sort of they're just like, you do your thing, whatever?
I would say that in years past, we've had quite a struggle of getting our university to just simply listen to us. And it's not that I don't think that they care, but universities are federally required to check boxes, and they felt that they were checking all of those boxes. And so my organization was small, and it felt like since my freshman year here on campus, I've been kind of screaming from the rooftops trying to get people to listen that this issue is happening on campus. And so once we were able to have the data and we had the survivors and we were like, hey, listen, it's not just us. It's not just us four raging feminists who are trying to tackle this issue. Students need your help, and we can't do it without your support. And so we feel that we have much more support than we did in the beginning. But of course, we're still always pushing and trying to apply the pressure on them to do more, because the best part about the It's On Us organization is that we understand that it's truly on every single one of us to combat this issue. It can't just be students. It has to be the administration, and it's their responsibility to ensure they're doing everything they can to keep us safe.
Now, I feel like I have to ask this of anyone who ever comes on the show, because we're all in this pandemic together, right? So how has COVID-19 affected any of your work, Tracy, and, you know, just the cases? You know, some people might say, well, everybody's locked up at home, so this stuff is not happening anymore.
It's interesting, because we have seen an increase in the number of calls to the crisis lines at our rape crisis centers. And it may not be that an incident has just occurred, but the pandemic has been very triggering for survivors wherever they are in their healing journey. And that's one of the great things about having a rape crisis center available to survivors, is that this is a healing journey. It goes long beyond the actual incident itself. And often survivors don't even have recall of what exactly happened to them until years later. So we have seen an increase in the calls of folks who have been triggered, and we have seen a decrease in visits to the hospitals. And we believe that's actually getting a little bit better, but initially there was such a fear of COVID and going to hospitals. So we were very concerned that survivors were not getting the needed medical attention and the appropriate forensic exams. So those are the two big things that we have seen. But real quick, one thing that Caitlin mentioned, you know, she talked about being the four feminists and really leading this charge. This is a community issue. This isn't for women to solve by themselves. And actually, we are working very hard to engage men in this movement, because their voices are so critical. The vast majority of men do not commit sexually violent acts, but the majority of perpetrators are men. So we've got to enlist this incredibly powerful group to become very engaged in stating their opposition to rape culture and their support for survivors and their belief of survivors. So if we're going to really move this needle and really end sexual violence, we need all voices to be actively and authentically engaged in these conversations.
Mm-hmm. And I think also there's a misconception that only women are survivors of rape when there are also men who are victims. And so is there any work that you do for men and women alongside each other?
Our rape crisis centers certainly work with anyone who has been sexually assaulted, no matter their gender identity. And we've done the service providers are incredibly equipped to handle all of the various needs of survivors, no matter who they are. We absolutely have got to. There's an exponential increase in the attacks against LGBTQ communities. We have, I think it's like 1 in 6 boys are sexually assaulted in Indiana. This is it's not just a women's issue. It's not just for women to solve, and it doesn't only impact women. So we've got to take the blinders off and really recognize that this this issue exists, and we're much stronger working together.
Absolutely. Well, we'll have to end on that note and say that we're definitely much better when we work together. Thank you so much, Tracy and Caitlin, for joining us this afternoon. And I want to thank you for taking the time with us. Caitlin Vincey is a student and an It's On Us campus coordinator for Students for Gender Violence Awareness Club at the University of Southern Indiana. Tracy Krueger is the president and CEO of the Indiana Coalition to End Sexual Assault and Human Trafficking. Our producers are Drew Dodlin, Micah Yason, and Tim Brooks. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like to hear this show again or listen to a past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Join us tomorrow for a conversation about Indiana employers and making accommodations for pregnant employees. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In. We'll